Hello and welcome to Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always I'm joined by my co-host, the limpid Luke Cutfer.
Excuse me?
This week we're talking about forgetting facts and misplaced memories. But first, I've got a wee review.
What does it say?
It says best podcast ever, but it is in all caps, so it's being shouted at us.
Best podcast ever!
It's 5 stars, and it goes on to say, I was never really a podcast guy. That is until my friend Jamie recommended Sci Guys to me less than a year ago. I've been addicted ever since. Sci Guys has helped me so much in school and in general conversations about science. I absolutely love Luke's episode about quantum physics. Corey explains things so well, and never sounds condescending. Well, that's not true.
That's definitely not
that's
true.
That's not true at all. No, that's, thank you very much. But like, you don't need to lie.
You need to do it more.
Thanks so much, guys. From a huge fan, Tom. Well, thank you, Tom. And I guess thank you also to Jamie for recommending us to Tom.
I like the idea that Sci Guys is a gateway drug.
He wasn't into podcasts before, but now he's addicted to podcasts.
Oh, that's it. We'll get you hooked. And speaking of hooked, I've got a question for anyone who's watching or listening. And if you're watching, go to the YouTube comments, obviously. If you're listening, I want you to listen closely, okay? Think very, very hard. Leave a memory in your brain, okay? Leave it for 20 years. You must live 20 years. If you leave this memory in your brain, you will live 20 years, I promise you, okay? That is the answer to your question. And in 20 years' time, once technology has developed sufficiently, I want you to use a non-Elon Musk brain chip to send a message out into the ether, and it will be sent back through time to us. Probably. The question is, do you have a good memory?
Not anymore. I think you've just ruined every single bit of my brain.
Fantastic. We can start anew with some information. And I guess I'll start with a question. The question is, what is amnesia?
Well, it's the experience of forgetting something. But frequently, like pathologized forgetting things. Medical forgetting things. Yeah. Forgetting things, but a doctor says it.
So yeah, that's not untrue. Amnesia is just the loss of memory. Usually it happens. Can you guess why?
Because you get older?
Brain
damage?
Yeah, damage to the brain. Trauma, stroke, Alzheimer's, which we've done an episode on, alcohol, drug toxicity, infection. Many different damages to the brain can be done. And many of them can cause amnesia. It could be anterograde. Do you know what that means?
Like short term?
So it means that events following the thing that causes the amnesia are forgotten.
Yes, this is maybe like when you have dementia, you can remember things from a very long time ago in your childhood, but then things that happen right now, you maybe forget them almost immediately.
Yeah, it basically prevents you from forming new memories.
Yeah.
Forming new memories properly is kind of the gist of it there. Do you know where amnesia comes from? The word, the etymology.
Oh, I'm going to guess it's Latin.
Well, it's wrong. It's ancient Greek.
50-50.
I mean, A, without mnesis.
Memory?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, wish the ancient Greeks chose a better way of saying that.
What about Sia? Mm-hmm. Oh, Sia, as in the musician Sia.
No. It's mnesis. It just changes its ending to Sia. So, mnesis. This is really terrible. Why are we doing this? We don't know ancient Greek. I mean, I know some ancient Greek, but I've never read it out loud because no one knows how to pronounce ancient Greek. Did you know that? No one knows how the Greeks speak. If only there was modern Greek to give us a hand, but there isn't because they all died out. Anyway, do you know what a fugue state is?
Excuse me, what?
A fugue state.
Yeah, I've heard the term, but I wouldn't be able to give you a definition.
It's okay. I'll tell you what the definition is. Amnesia might last for weeks, months, years, long periods of time, Luke. And during that time, someone can do lots of things. I mean, you know, you could start a new life within the space of a couple years, right? You definitely did it. And that sort of period of amnesia, that period of not remembering stuff from outside of that period, that would be called a fugue state. So that sort of period of weeks or months wherein you don't remember things and you form new memories and you go and start a new life, for example, let's say, that would be a fugue state.
Wow, okay.
And often, once you sort of recover from the fugue state, you can remember stuff that happened before it, but you can't remember what happened during. That's the vibe there.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of stuff in the news recently about this because of Matthew Perry, who like lost several years of his life memory-wise, to like whilst he was filming Friends, because he had addiction problems and he just can't remember anything that happened in that period.
Yeah, I don't think that's actually the same thing, because the sort of key part of a fugue state is that in the fugue state, you can't remember outside of it. And generally, afterwards, you can't remember anything sort of within it, right?
Wow.
If you think of it almost as a separate sort of like brain bubble, where the memories outside and inside are kind of separated. Yeah. That's my understanding of it, at least. So what you're kind of talking about would be more, I guess, addiction-related memory loss, wherein he doesn't remember anything from that period, or he didn't remember anything from that period. You know, in the same sense that if you go out and start drinking to the point of blacking out, you don't remember anything from the period of blacking out.
Yeah.
You can remember before blacking out, perhaps, and after blacking out, but during the blackout, you don't remember anything from that, you know? That would be more like a fugue state if, like, sort of during...
So if you got so drunk that you couldn't remember who you were or any of your life experiences, and then you just, like, were just crazy drunk and you couldn't remember who you were, but you were just living, and then next morning you couldn't remember what you were doing in that state, then that state was a fugue state.
Well, a fugue state, I think, needs to last a long period of time, like weeks, months, years.
But to understand it...
Basically, you lose your memory, right? You forget who you are and whatnot for a long period of time. And then when you regain those memories, you are unlikely to remember what happened in that intervening period of time.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And the thing is, like, an episode on amnesia, you'd think it would be an easy one, you know, in terms of like, oh, amnesia, it's amnesia. We must know a lot about that. We know some things about amnesia, but also amnesia doesn't mean one thing. Amnesia literally is just not remembering things, loss of memory, essentially, right? And so it's a very broad topic. So if there's anything that you find interesting, Luke, or, you know, the viewers or listeners, anything they find interesting, we could absolutely do another episode on a more specific topic. But as usual, it's fun to do just kind of a overview on the whole thing. What do you think are some causes of memory loss, of amnesia, can be?
I would guess you've had some physical trauma to your brain. Mm. You've had like some interruption of blood flow, like in a stroke. Mm. Or you've got sort of a degenerative disease where like bits of your brain are sort of wasting away. Anything else?
Yes, there's lots of different causes of amnesia. You know, it could be stress, anxiety or depression, insomnia. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a study later on that uses sort of sleep deprivation to cause memory loss, to cause amnesia. But you kind of hit them all other than those ones. Traumatic head injury. So yeah, like actual physical trauma to the brain. Hypoxia, I think you already mentioned. Viral infection can cause amnesia. But again, that would sort of be damage to the brain through disease. So herpes simplex encephalitis can cause amnesia. Korsakoff syndrome, which is like alcoholic Korsakoff syndrome. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I did look it up and I've now forgotten, but that's quite ironic. Go ahead and look it up yourself. But you could also have amnesia due to sort of emotional shock, severe emotional shock, wherein personal memories and identity and whatnot are affected. That would be more sort of psychological rather than sort of, I guess, neurobiological. There's kind of like a difference between those things there, right? You can understand likely what the difference is. If something is kind of neurological or whatnot, it's more likely to be sort of a physical change rather than psychological, wherein there's not necessarily any physical damage. There's some kind of psychological block there. I know less about that. I mean, I know not very much about any of this. I looked it up and I'm reading it out to you, but I found less information on that. We could probably do an entire episode on it, to be perfectly honest with you. But shall we talk a little bit about memories? We've spoken about amnesia. We've spoken about sort of memory loss. I think it's probably useful to, at some point, talk about what memories actually are.
And the answer is we don't necessarily know.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a decent idea of how memories kind of work. There are, 2015, there were definitely sort of big debates on how does this work, how does it work, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, we don't know 100%, I would say, but we've got a decent enough idea. So generally, memory would be the ability to retain information and get it back at some later time. You know, for example, when you do a thing, and it hurts you, later on, you can see that thing and be like, that thing hurt me the last time I interacted with it. Therefore, I will avoid that thing.
Unless you're Bart Simpson and there's an electric cupcake nearby.
That is very true. But a hamster would, in fact, be able to remember that and avoid it. Yeah, no. Memory is essentially a really useful thing, right? You can understand why it's evolutionarily incredibly useful. If something bad happens and you survive it, you're less likely to interact with that bad thing or have that bad thing happen again if you can remember that it happened and avoid it. In the very simplest sense, I guess you could say that memory would allow you to avoid sort of dangers that are not immediately lethal, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I guess as well, memory to a greater degree is what allows for human sort of society, right? Yeah, we write stuff down and we tell each other things, we tell stories, we can retain so much information. Like, if you really think about the amount of information that a human can contain in the head, it's insane. It's a lot.
But so much of it is subconscious, so we don't really realize. Like, if you think about, oh, this is how I interact with this person, this is what this person likes, this is like how I, like, how me and this person, like, ever, all the biological, biographical information of me and this person's history, like, and you just, that's just apparent to you when you see someone.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, right there.
Yeah. And also memories that you're not even aware that you've got. So for example, if you were to tell a story about the two of us from, say, 5 years ago, right? And I'm like, oh, I don't really remember that thing happening, when you say the broad strokes of it. Then you start telling it and I'm like, oh, it's all coming back to me now.
Yeah, weird.
And there's more information. Yeah, the memory is more complex than you might initially imagine. And it's, we still don't understand it completely. It's so interesting in that respect. And yeah, there are different types of memory. Do you know any of the different types of memory?
Biographical memory? Spatial memory?
Yeah, okay. So,
photographic memory?
So those are all words that have memory at the end of them.
Sexy memory.
Okay, so I'm just going to tell you the different types of memory that I've got in front of me.
Yep.
Would that be okay with you?
That would be, it sounds like I could do with that, yes.
Yeah, okay. So there are different ways of sort of divvying up memories. So you could talk about short-term memory and long-term memory and working memory.
Yeah.
Long-term memory is not a thing. It's just memory. No, so working memory, do you know what that is?
Is that like where you've like got some information and you're kind of manipulating it in your head?
Yeah, it's basically that sort of limited information, holding it there temporarily whilst sort of doing information processing.
There's not a lot of that.
Yeah,
it's like five numbers or something.
Well, I mean, a phone, you can repeat a phone number in your head. Do you know what I mean? Sort of thing. Like, whenever, if you're, say, repeating a phone number or repeating something back to yourself over and over and over to keep it in your head, to say, transfer it from like one place to another, that would be, you know, your working memory.
It's
that you're
like
using.
RAM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
In a computer. Yeah.
For example, right? I feel like if people are sort of trying to remember their card number of their debit card, a lot of people don't necessarily remember that. What is it? 16 digit number.
I can remember
in its
four
entirety.
Of those. Yeah.
I remember all sets of four individually and never together. Never, like, I can read like one of them and be like, oh yeah, that's the rest of it, obviously. But I can't do that with the whole 16 digit thing because I've never tried. But yeah, no, I think people will generally sort of, you know, they'll run that back to themselves. The 16 numbers is maybe a bit too much. They'll do it in sort of blocks of four, maybe eight, right? You know, that sort of number doesn't tend to stick in your long-term memory, but it also doesn't need to, because you're only usually ever using it with your working memory, really sort of like quickly, like, I need to do this thing, put it in there. Then it's kind of gone. It's temporarily there quite often, right? That would be working memory, just sort of temporarily holding information whilst you process it for some reason. That could be, you know, reading out a phone number or an address or anything like that, you know, where you've kind of, you're just kind of like processing information, using it for a limited period of time. And, you know, crucially, there is that's a sort of limited amount of information that you could do that with. Like, you know, you're saying a few numbers. Yeah, you can't have a huge amount of information in your working memory. Just doesn't really work that way. Short-term memories, they last second to hours. Long-term memories last up to years. I say up to years, they last for years. And yeah, we've done an episode on memories before, I think. So you could go back and check that one out. If we did do it. If we didn't do it, then
we will.
Yeah, watch this one.
We can't remember.
Ah, it's very good. Yeah, it's a good one. It's good.
Low hanging fruit.
But other ways to categorize memories, you could kind of talk about whether you experience it consciously, because you were talking earlier on there, you know, about not being able to consciously remember some stuff. So there's declarative memory. I think that's how you pronounce it, right? That's a very odd word with syllables. Gonna use that pronunciation or a different one if I forget. And there's also non-declarative memory. So explicit memory and implicit memory, respectively, right? So explicit memory is pretty straightforward, right? It's pretty self-explanatory. Sort of facts, things that you've experienced, sort of things, you know, sort of say, you can say. So, you know, the capital of, say, France would be
Paris.
That's very true. And how old am I?
26.
Very good. How many cards in a normal deck of cards, not including jokers?
52.
Well done. And how many frames per second for a human to perceive it as movement?
About 24.
Well done. All of that would be
I passed the test.
You did.
Quick fire quiz.
Your explicit memory, right? And your implicit memory, do you have any idea what that might be?
I would imagine it's things like remembering the layout of a building. Like something you don't necessarily know that you know, but then you can kind of navigate it.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, that would fall under that, I guess, because
like you just know where to go. You don't think about the fact that you know where to go, you just know where to go.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that the other day, actually, where I was like, you know, I don't know if I know the area that I live in because I don't know street names anymore. Yeah. Back in my hometown, I was better at street names because they were, I guess, just more visible. And they had the big bloody signs everywhere. And when I'm driving, I'm kind of using them and it's more, you know what I mean? When you're living in a sort of smaller place, you are more likely to know the street names, I guess, because people say, oh, it's on this street, it's on that street. Whereas around where I live, I don't need to know the street names. I just know where things are.
Yeah.
If I want to walk to Sainsbury, I do know the name of the Sainsbury's because there are a few Sainsbury's around me. And sometimes when I Google to check which one's open, I need to know which one it is. That's the only reason that I know what street some of the Sainsbury's are on. But like ultimately, you could change the street signs around me and I probably wouldn't notice for quite some time.
The reason I think the spatial memory stuff might be like subconscious is because if you think about giving someone directions to something, there's almost like a pause whilst you sort of turn it into knowledge. Do you know what I mean? So you're like taking it from one place and putting it into another.
No, absolutely. I'm with you. So what was going on there was the process in my head of thinking like, well, no, yeah, that does make sense. That is how that seems to work. But then also you can just kind of say things like you can know spaces in that sort of declarative sense, but no, I think you're spot on. It would be implicit memory, if spatial memory were to fall into one of those two sort of categories. Riding a bike, for example, that would be implicit memory.
Driving a car,
exactly. Like cooking is so implicit for me.
Yeah.
I think there are some people that's the thing, though. Do you know what I mean? I think some people do a lot of cooking things with explicit.
Yes. Well, that's the point of practice, isn't it? Like when you're playing piano, you're trying to make playing the piano a subconscious task where you're just feeling it and your fingers are just kind of doing their thing. And you're like, thanks, fingers. But when you're starting, it's all conscious. And that's why it's so slow, because your conscious memory is like kind of crap, really, isn't it? It's not very good at like remembering a bunch of stuff, especially like motor stuff. Motor stuff has to be subconscious.
Yeah. I mean, like, dude, I don't even know if I could tell you what the keyboard shortcuts are for editing.
Oh, yeah. No idea.
I genuinely think I would have to do it and look. I'm like, oh, this is cut. This is split. This is what this, like, I don't know. The brain just automatically transfers what I want to do onto the screen. Like, there's no intervening point there. You know what I mean? It's really interesting in that sense. But yeah, so riding a bike, playing an instrument, that would be sort of procedural memories. Those fall under implicit memory, right? Procedural memory is basically remembering skills that you've got. So yes, I guess video editing would fall under that. You know, again, playing an instrument, like you said, driving, all of those sorts of things. But it can also shape sort of your responses to things, like your physiological responses. So salivating when you see some tasty food that you like, that would fall under implicit memory. So remembering that sort of like, oh, this is a tasty food that I like the smell of. It's not like you consciously think. You know what I mean? Like,
I would like to salivate now.
Yeah, it's not like you're, oh, I'm smelling this thing. I mean, you can imagine, right? Smelling something like, oh, that smells really good. What is that? And you're salivating already because your body's like, I know I like this. And then you're like, cinnamon buns. It's cinnamon buns I'm smelling. And there could be a lag between your body knowing what it is and being this good thing, I want thing, and your brain being like, What is it that I want? But tell me what is thing, please. Yeah. So do you know what I mean? That would be sort of the difference there. Basically, kind of facts and sort of stuff that you can sort of just consciously say, sort of to remember, and then that sort of less explicit stuff, the stuff that's more sort of procedural, stuff that you wouldn't necessarily be able to automatically just say out loud. This is how thing. How do you ride a bike? Well, I don't know. I just get on a bike and it's moving. You know, like that's how it works. So that's memories and the different types. Shall we talk a little bit about how memories form?
Yeah, go on. I think it's like connections between areas. Is that right?
Yeah.
Strengthening those connections. There's not like one memory place, is what I'm getting at.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that is so true. So since the 40s, scientists have kind of had the idea that neurons hold memories, or rather groups of sort of like brain cells hold memories, essentially through the sort of connections that they make between each other. They will fire in response to a specific stimulus, and then whether it's, you know, regardless of what that thing is, whether it's sort of that smell that you like, or whether it's, you know, seeing the theme song or hearing the theme song of a TV show that you like, or seeing the Sci Guys logo, anything, seeing, you know, someone that you know, they'll fire and they'll sort of all fire together. And that sort of firing together strengthens the connection between them. And those sort of strengthened connections then sort of lead to, I guess, stronger memories, right?
Or more accessible memories as well. Yeah,
exactly. And so that sort of collective activity is a memory, and it is a little bit more complex than we're letting on. And sort of strengthening a memory in that way doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be more accurate necessarily. Mm. It is probably going to make it more accessible, absolutely, yeah. But it doesn't. Memories that you recall a lot aren't necessarily infallible. We've spoken about this definitely before.
Yeah.
There's this kind of idea that memories can still be sort of malleable when they're sort of being recalled. And so in recalling a memory, you could literally be altering the memory. And, you know, you've probably had an experience where you're recollecting something. You're remembering something with a friend. You're reminiscing with a friend, right? And you both have different memories of how something happened.
It's because they're from a different universe.
Sure. Or both of you are wrong, or one of you is right. And
I'm right. They're from a different universe.
Right. Okay. Or memory is fallible. That's the point there. Do you know what consolidation is?
Is it like memories that sort of combine, like cross over each other? Or is it like reinforcing a memory?
No, it's literally sort of bringing a short-term memory into your long-term memory.
So
I think that kind of happens as well.
Hippocampus.
It kind of happens as well during sleep. I think that's one of the, again, sleep is another thing that we're like, yeah.
Your hippocampus is like, I don't want any more memories. I've got a lot of memories to go through. I need you to stop experiencing things entirely.
Yeah, so it's strengthening memories for long-term storage, essentially. Yeah, so you're spot on. And yeah, we think that's one of the reasons that sleep is so important. I say we're pretty sure. We know that memory consolidation happens during sleep. I'm pretty sure we know that. The reason I'm being so sort of coy and cautious around all of this sort of stuff is only because memory, sleep, all of these sort of brain-related things, we are not 100% sure on all of it. There's a lot of research still to be done, and it's a really difficult thing to understand. And we're asking a lot of why questions, like why does this happen? And why questions are notoriously bloody difficult to answer, particularly in biology, because it's not like you can very easily find the answer. Do you know what I mean? There could be any number of reasons why something happens.
Yeah, why? Because those that didn't do it, they're dead.
Yeah.
That's why.
Like, honestly, there are some things that are there just as an added thing because there wasn't an evolutionary pressure to get rid of that thing.
Yeah.
And they arose. Like, why are people ginger?
Because it's sexy.
Mutation, probably. And it wasn't a
Rude.
Harmful mutation. So,
Rude.
Come on, man.
Sexy.
Fine, whatever, a sexy mutation. But yeah, no. So all animals that have long-term memories use the same sort of basic cellular stuff that we do to sort of consolidate and stabilize their long-term memories. For example, when we were sort of figuring this stuff out, I think we used, is it banana slugs? California sea slugs, I apologize, not banana slugs, very different thing. But yeah, we figured out long-term long-term memory consolidation using California sea slugs, which is pretty bloody interesting that something so different from us can do such a similar process, which would sort of imply what, Luke?
That it evolved a very, 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 very long time ago.
Yes.
Or that it's so ubiquitous that every single thing constantly evolves it. Like eyes in octopuses, I think, are one of those things where like they separately evolved eyes because eyes are just so good.
Or crabs in, or in crabs. Crabs.
Everyone wants to be crab. Eventually we'll be crabs.
Okay, shall we explain carcinization?
No, it needs no explanation. You want to be a crab? I want to be a crab. You at home, you want to be a crab? Everyone wants to be a crab. Even crabs want to be crabs.
I'm going to explain it anyway. So lots of things in the ocean, crustaceans specifically, end up looking like crabs. A lot of things that look like crabs aren't crabs, and lots of things keep evolving into crabs. The reason being that if you're in a niche and you share a niche with something else, you're likely going to share similar features because that niche that you're in, that sort of ecological niche, the conditions that are in sort of your environment that you're utilizing, they're going to be, if they're similar, you're going to need the same things, right? So let's say, for example, bats and birds all evolved wings, right? Because they, for some reason, it was beneficial to them to fly. And, you know, the way that evolution sort of works, it's sort of the path of least resistance generally, or the best, easiest path. It's really difficult to kind of encapsulate evolution in its entirety into sort of one simple phrase. But yeah, sort of the path of least resistance is generally how it works. And if there is a really, really good sort of way of doing something, then a lot of different things with the same sort of pressures are likely going to evolve the same sort of shape. So, for example, a crab has kind of got this tail that is kind of tucked in under it. It's got a very sort of small, compact body with legs that kind of go out to the side, generally, and the big sort of claws. It's really good for whatever niche that it's in, whether that's like sort of scavenging or whatever. I don't know that much about crabs. But the point is that if you have sort of similar ecological niches, you're probably going to look similar. So, for example, an elephant shrew, I'm pretty sure, is more related to an elephant than it is a shrew, despite the fact that it looks really similar to a shrew.
So weird.
Reason being that they both do the same sort of thing. So they need, again, sort of applying these words to it is difficult, but they need the sort of same, I guess, biological features, the same sort of physiology to kind of succeed in that niche. You know, for example, fish, right? There are plenty of fish, I'm pretty sure. I think the lungfish, I say plenty of fish, I'm pretty sure the lungfish is more related to us than it is to cartilaginous fish like sharks and whatnot. And we generally think of fish as being sort of one thing, right? And lizards as well. We think of lizards as being one thing. But there are plenty of lizards that are more related to snakes than they are to other lizards. I'm pretty sure crocodiles are maybe more related to chickens or birds than they are to Komodo dragons. That's off the top of my head. Plenty of trees are more related to things that don't really look like trees than they are to other trees. Fish, I swear to God, there's a reason that there's no such thing as a fish. And it's because fish look the same, generally, because they're all living in the water. Hell, dolphins look like sharks, okay? Orcas look like sharks. Do you know why? Because they're in the same... They have dorsal fins! Why? An orca, I'm pretty sure whales are, like, pretty closely related to cows, right? Or say pretty closely related to cows, right? Like, pretty closely related to cows in the grand scheme of things,
considering
right?
That they're whales, yes.
Considering that they're whales, and all of all animals, right? And they have shark-like features. Why? Because they do the same bloody thing. They swim through the water and you need, you need a certain kind of like aerodynamic, let's say, build for that. A dorsal fin helps you sort of, I think, orient yourself, stay upright. And those fins on the side, the pectoral fins, they're useful for whatever they're useful for, and your tail, all of that sort of stuff is useful. And so if you're giving someone the same conditions, they're probably going to come to like a pretty similar answer, right? Like if you give 100 people a problem, you're probably going to have people ending up using the same sort of method to solve the problem if there is sort of a quite clear best method, let's say. Do you know what I mean? Or an easiest method. A lot of people will end up using that same method. And it's a similar sort of thing when it comes to evolution and carcinization, wherein, man, evolution isn't like trying to be fancy. It's not trying anything. Evolution is just the process by which things adapt to their environment. And if you've got the same environment, you're probably going to make pretty similar adaptations.
Like I said, everyone wants to be a crab.
Okay, yeah, sure, whatever. So we've done memories, long-term memory, short-term memory, consolidation from short-term into long-term.
I'd completely forgotten what this episode was about.
It's about amnesia, which, again, ironic.
I was in the Sharky Crab world at that point. Amnesia? We're talking about amnesia. That's, how did we get, okay, please, carry on.
I don't think I will. Ding-ling-ling. Are you there, God? It's me, the Ad Bell.
Ugh, what do you want?
I want the lovely listeners and viewers of SciGuys to know that they can support the show without spending any of their own money.
Right, and what do you want me to do about it?
Well, I want you to tell them all that they can do that by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for SciGuys.
Hello, SciGuys listeners. It's me, God. You can support the show by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving a 5-star, very nice review.
And don't forget, if you don't have access to Apple Podcasts, it helps just as much to go ahead and leave a lovely YouTube comment. Amen.
Are we done? I've got a plague to organize.
Okay, let's get back to the show. Okay, look, now I'll carry on. Have you heard of Henry Mollison? Henry M.
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah, no.
No? Well, I'll tell you about him. He's actually the most famous case study in anterograde amnesia. In 1953, he had parts of his brain removed. Don't worry. It was a treatment for severe seizures. That's why they did it.
Okay.
No other reason. There actually is no other reason. But yeah, so when he was 7 or perhaps 9, it is hard to tell because records are not good. So when he was about 7, he was hit by a bike, or when he was 9. And at age 10, he started to have minor seizures. And then after 16, he had sort of more major seizures. And he worked on an assembly line for a bit. But by 1953, when he was 27, he was just having so many seizures, he could not do that. He had anticonvulsant medication, like high doses, but in spite of that, he just couldn't live a normal life. So a surgeon, you can tell this was a surgeon that offered this, offered to cut out some of his brain in an experimental procedure that he'd only ever done on psychotic patients. And so the patient, Henry, was like, yep, sure, okay, fine, cut out this part of my brain. His family were like, yep, sure, that's fine, cut out this part of his brain. And he went and he did it. His epilepsy was fine, under control.
Is this the same part of the brain that they do for seizures now, which is the corpus callosum?
I'm actually not sure. Are you talking about the split?
The link between the two hemispheres.
I'm not actually sure which part of the brain that he took out, but he took out like a bit of his brain.
Oh, he took out a bit. Okay.
Yeah, no, he didn't. He didn't sever. Yeah, yeah, they didn't sever. He literally removed a piece of brain. And what happened is the epilepsy, all good, under control, very fine. Couldn't remember new stuff though.
Oh. All the
old stuff, he could remember that pretty well. The other patients, they didn't have any sort of intellectual loss or any sort of perceptual disorders, but when it came to sort of recalling some old information, he was a bit impaired, and specifically in sort of creating new memories, he was quite severely impaired. So he would underestimate his own age. He would forget people that he'd been introduced to. Although I say, actually, some old memories were kind of affected. Forgetting your own age is like kind of probably down to not being able to remember how much time has passed since you last remembered your age. You know what I mean? So he thought he was younger than he was all the time. He would forget people's names when he was immediately introduced to them. I know that feeling. And, you know, he kind of described it as like waking from a dream every day is alone in itself. So essentially what happened there is that he just was unable to form sort of new memories. Oh, I think he was able to form like some new memories, but some specific sort of memory consolidation part of his brain was just not functioning properly.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about like conscious memories and unconscious memories. I think the most unconscious memory of all that we have is the sense that we're like a continuous person day to day. And the fact that like we experience that as like so fundamental to the way we understand the world. It's like, oh, I'm the same person I was yesterday. I'm the same person I was 10 years ago.
Mm.
And you take that away, you can't even comprehend what the experience of life is like.
Well, moment to moment, you wouldn't be able to comprehend it, let alone sort of day to day is maybe a bit more understandable. You'd be like, oh, cool, I can go through a day and remember my entire day, and then a new day the next day. But like that sort of moment to moment, it seems very strange. It's like I think I've been sort of in university, I drank a little too much, and I kind of came back from a blackout while still conscious, and it's almost like coming back into myself. It was like, whoa, I've not gone to sleep and forgotten something. I just don't remember the past 2 hours. Wow. Where am I? What happened? Do you know what I mean? That was like literally one time.
It's like being born, but every day.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm a thing.
Yeah.
Who am I? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you've got a full brain.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Like language.
Which is insane, right? Like not being able to remember, like, okay, obviously you don't remember how you learned to speak whatever language you speak, right? But not...
To be fair, none of us do.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. you don't remember that, but then kind of like, you know, coming to and being like, not remembering other stuff about yourself, but being able to communicate just naturally, that to me, I think would feel very strange. Because language is obviously something that is so natural to us, but like still it's kind of built, your short vocabulary is built from your life experiences. Do you know what I mean? Right. Yeah. Like I wouldn't have the same vocabulary I did if I didn't read the same books that I did when I was younger, if I didn't engage in the same sort of media that I engage in now. Right. The thing is that like language is so much a part of who you are that it would feel very strange, I think, alienating almost, to be a different person and still have just language from a life that I don't recall.
Yeah.
You know, that concept just seems so odd to me. But yeah, no, this guy, we studied him. I say we, you and I did not do that, but others did study him for quite some time. He was the basis for how we kind of understand memory. Looking at this guy, I mean, studies are still sort of cited today. Studies on him are still sort of cited today. He died in 2008, December 2nd, at the age of 82, which is kind of mad, right? 2008, the man that's sort of the basis for our understanding of memory. Died, you know, 2008 at 82 years old. Wild. But yeah, no, we don't, you know, fully understand how memories work, but we do kind of understand generally how the whole thing happens. And this guy was pretty important in that. And the key thing that you've sort of brought up there, Luke, is that there's not one part of your brain that's the memory hole. There's not like a memory section of your brain. It seems that sort of different areas of your brain store different kinds of memories, different processes kind of happen to make those different memories sort of work, right? So it's not like there's one process for creating memories and it happens in one part of your brain. There's many different parts of your brain that are sort of used in memory, and those different parts may use different processes. The amygdala, for example, can you give us any information on the amygdala?
I think that's what controls the fight or flight response, and I think it's also involved in antisocial personality disorder, like underactive amygdala.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a fight or flight, sort of emotional stuff generally. And so memories that your amygdala is kind of involved in tend to be those kind of trauma, like very emotional ones, right? Where like, oh, I can't necessarily remember like what I could see or feel or anything, but like the emotion, like, you know, like that sort of PTSD type sort of flashback thing, your amygdala is kind of involved in that. And you know, the hippocampus, for example, is for declarative memories. The temporal lobes in this guy, in Henry, were partially missing, and those are kind of used for forming and recalling memories just sort of generally, right? And so that would make sense as to why he wasn't able to form new memories, because those parts of his brain were damaged, essentially removed, right? And yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting that like your whole brain is kind of used in memory, right? Or rather, there's not just one part of your brain that's like the little memory store.
Yeah, memory is a thing that all of your brain does, as opposed to a thing that a part of your brain does.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's fundamental to just being a brain.
Shall we talk about restoring memories now, Luke?
Restoring memories?
Yes, restoring memories.
As in, like, bringing them back.
As in, bringing them back.
Like hypnosis.
No, not like that, but let's move on anyway. So I found this study from 2015 wherein they restored memories in mice. So they stimulated memory engrams, which are these sort of neurons that are activated as memories are formed. Essentially, they went into little mice brains and they added these sort of light sensitive proteins to their brains. They muddled with them a little bit. Essentially, the idea being that you shine a light at this mouse and and it sort of lights up these neurons in its head, right? Don't worry too much about how they did it. It's wild, but story for another day, I suppose, right? And so essentially what they did was they tortured these mice just a touch by shocking their feet. Because when you do that, they freeze up because they're scared because you're shocking their feet. And they would essentially, they essentially sort of did that to some mice, and then they made them forget it. And it shows that when, you know, they're in that room where they had their feet shocked before, they wouldn't sort of, they didn't have that reaction because they forgot the sort of the negative negative stimulus that they had, right? Whereas when they did sort of the same thing with mice that had been made to forget this sort of stimulus, right? And they shone a blue light on them with the sort of light stimulated the light sensitive proteins that are sort of linked to these neurons, the mice ended up sort of freezing as though they remembered the experience that they had been made to forget. So essentially you can use some chemicals, do different things to sort of remove memories, right? And so they removed memories, but then showed that the mice were able to actually recall these memories when stimulated with this light. And what that sort of means, or would sort of imply, is that memories aren't necessarily lost, sort of like written over.
Yeah.
It's more that they just can't be recalled.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was sort of the basis for that idea. That was kind of like a back and forth. And to be honest, I'm not really sure where we've ended up, but I have found more research kind of sort of underlining or supporting that idea that in many cases, memories aren't necessarily lost. It's just access to them is lost. And it's kind of what we were talking about earlier on, right? Where, you know, you're having a conversation with a friend, reminiscing, and then there's something that you don't necessarily remember that suddenly you're able to remember with that sort of little influence from someone you're talking to. It's not exactly the same thing,
of course.
That's
the light proteins.
Well, sure, but like the light here isn't necessarily important. I want to make that clear for anyone that's listening. The light here is just a way to, I guess, stimulate these specific neurons to sort of bring back the memory. The point there being that the neurons are still there, the connections are still there. It's just accessing them and accessing that sort of network that is the problem. That seems to be the sort of bottleneck, the stopgap, rather than the connections themselves being sort of dissipated. And it's kind of interesting because it's not really how we would generally think of memory, right? It's not really how computer memory works, for example, right? You can't like write over, you know, if you completely delete something from a hard drive, you're unlikely to be able to get that back.
Yes, but actually there is an analogy in hard drives for exactly what you're describing, which is that the way that a hard drive stores information is that when you delete something, it doesn't actually go over that specific area where that file was and deletes it. It just basically deletes it from like essentially like what, like the index.
Yeah, like the lookup table.
At the start
sort of, thing,
imagine the start of a book where it's got all the pages with what's on the pages. It's just like you scribbled out what's on the page. And then when you then come to use that page, it will write over it. Mm. But until you do that, it just sort of goes like, there's nothing on this page. Woo. So it is recoverable. And that's sort of exactly what they did with those mice. That's sort of a sort of analog to what
actually,
happened there.
Yeah, no, yeah, that is pretty spot on. Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Although I don't think you're able to necessarily write over.
No, but neuron, I mean, up to that point.
No,
you
I agree
it from
with you.
From the index.
That's the difficult thing here where I'm like, there's this one specific thing that I'm using this analogy for. And I'm like, actually, no, you're so right that it's really similar in this way and then really different in that other way. But yeah, no, that's a great way of kind of like explaining it. Yeah. It's not that the memory is gone. It's just that you can't find it almost, let's say, or you can't bring it back. Yeah. Very good. And there was another study in 2023, kind of following on from that, where they sort of induced amnesia basically using sort of sleep deprivation, sleep loss. And they had sort of these mice learn things whilst in a sort of sleep deprived state, and they brought back these memories afterwards. So after 2 days of the training that these mice had, where, you know, you train them when they're sleep deprived and they can't store those memories because memory consolidation is impacted through sleep deprivation, right? What they did was they taught them something during that state, and then 2 days later, they did the same sort of light stimulation thing because it was the same idea going on there. Don't worry too much about it. That's just the method that we're using to bring the memories back. It's not super important to the actual base sort of theory that's going on there. But they after the light stimulation, you know, 2 days after the training, the memories had come back. The mice had remembered what they had learned, which would suggest that sort of sleep deprivation amnesia that you get, the sort of lack of ability to sort of form memories or consolidate memories when you're in a sleep deprived state, is not an inability to sort of form those connections hold them. It's an inability to sort of recall. And this is only over like 2 days, of course. But still, that's really interesting there, right? You formed the memory, you just can't access it or reinforce it.
Yeah, it's like you've written down all this information and then you've just not written down where you've written it down.
Yeah.
But you have written it down, you just can't find it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of is interesting because you see this sort of state-dependent memory idea in TV shows a lot, you know, where characters are like, oh, we got blackout drunk last night and we lost the keys to the van.
Let's
and
get
the
drunk
owner
again.
Of the van is coming back. Yes, let's get drunk again. State-dependent memory. And they do it and they remember, right? And it almost lends credence to that idea.
Kind of checks out.
I'm not saying that that is true, but do you know what I mean? It's interesting.
The idea that the memory is there, it does exist, and you just need to change something to be able to access the memory, fundamentally is borne out in the data.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting, right? It's a really interesting idea because there are lots of things that we don't remember, but that we could just have stored up there in our heads. We're just not able to access it for some reason.
It's like when you smell
or
a
another.
Smell. You smell the smell, you're like, oh my God. Mine's always like, I smell like this one specific thing, and I'm like, oh wow, my girlfriend from when I was 13's house.
Jesus,
it's really weird. I was like, oh wow, I'm there. Crazy.
Wild. That is actually insane. Yeah. I don't really get that with smells all that often, I suppose. I mean, yeah, I guess I just know all my smells, you know? I don't have any
smell recall.
Yeah, like, yes, I remember that specific smell. No, I don't know, man. I don't know. I never get transported back to my 13-year-old girlfriend's house. I've never had a 13-year-old girlfriend. I'm not a creep, man. But it would imply that sleep deprivation-induced amnesia is more an issue of retrieving memories rather than forming memories, which I find really interesting. And they've used sort of drugs, I think, yeah, sort of chemical, rather, to re-access these memories, along with optogenetics, which would be using light-sensitive stuff in the brain and blah blah blah. You flash them with light and then it triggers something. That's what I was talking about earlier. I don't want to get into it, okay? I don't want to get into it.
For somebody who doesn't want to get into it, you do keep on almost getting into it.
Well, because look, I have an understanding of it to a degree, but not a degree where it's worthwhile talking about it on this
hold
show.
Up to scrutiny.
No, it's just like, look, I get it. I get how it works, right? I get it generally, and going into the specifics, it's not going to be useful or great for anyone.
It's like getting hung up on the electrodes in something that's like, we stimulated this area of the brain, and you're like, but what about the electrodes? I want to talk about the electrodes. It's like, no. We use the electrodes to stimulate the area of the brain. The area of the brain is important, not the electrodes.
Exactly. You don't need to worry about how electrodes work to find this interesting, right? But yeah, they used optogenetics and this sort of chemical to restore memory access, and you can permanently reverse amnesia due to sleep loss multiple days after learning. And this is in mice, of course. These past two studies I've just mentioned are in mice. So, grain of salt, it doesn't necessarily apply to humans, and realistically, these studies are not ethical to perform on humans, because of course they're not. Quite literally, it says that in the studies, and it's like, ooh, human studies on this, who knows, because can't shock humans' feet and make it okay.
It would be amazing for certain things, like for PTSD, especially like one single event PTSD, where it's not necessarily important that you remember that one time that something exploded and you didn't expect it. If you're like a war vet, for example, they then take that into like, oh, someone slams a door loudly or a car backfires and then you're triggered by that. If you could like isolate that, a memory you don't need to have, and just yoink, or just like cut off access to it, you could transform someone's life.
I'm glad that you've mentioned that, because that is something I've got here in my notes. So we were talking about sort of memories being temporarily malleable, and sort of remembering something and consolidation, that kind of puts memories in a sort of more malleable state, where they could be strengthened, weakened, or changed in some way. That's kind of to do with what we were mentioning about sort of when you remember something, you can kind of actually alter your memory of the thing just by the act of sort of remembering it, right?
Like exposure therapy kind of stuff.
Well, no, I mean more in the sense of just remembering something because you're remembering something that kind of it can kind of alter the memory. Like literally just in the base sort of
give it a little tweak and change
it. Yeah. It's like not even intentionally, it's just the you know, it's malleable. You can strengthen that connection, you can alter the connection slightly, or you can weaken the connection. Remembering stuff more doesn't necessarily make the memory more accurate. But what that does mean, you know, because there is this sort of malleable state that memories can be in, you can target them using memories during reconsolidation, which could then help treat things like PTSD, which is kind of what you're talking about there, right? Finding memories in a sort of malleable state and altering them so they're no longer harmful, or cutting off access in some way, you know, weakening the connections there, to sort of help treat PTSD, which is like quite interesting, I think, you know. And that would be sort of everything I've got on amnesia. It's very broad. We don't really know exactly how it works. We can sometimes reverse it, and it's not necessarily down to a complete loss of information, just the loss of ability to access that information. Of course, in the cases of traumatic brain injuries, or like quite literally surgery where parts of the brain are removed and whatnot, it is likely that those bits are gone because those bits of your brain are gone. But then it could also be caused by so many different things, right? Amnesia is not one thing. It's just the word that we use for when you can't remember stuff. And there's many different ways that that can happen. And I think crucially, the thing to take away is that memories are not necessarily as rigid as you might think. And there exists the possibility to restore lost memories, kind of Eternal Sunshine style, which is very cool. Very cool. But that's it. There you go.
Thank you very much. I have learned plenty.
And there's just one more thing to do, I suppose.
Dun, 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 dun.
It's the Quickfire Quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Amnesia edition.
Did you forget when you do your dun, 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 dun?
I did. I forgot. I'm sorry.
Well, I hope you didn't forget the rules for the Quickfire Quiz, because they are the same as always, Luke. I'll ask one question. That's one question between you and the audience. The first person to answer the question after finished asking it wins. What do they win, Luke?
A little electric shock to the feet.
Weird, kinky, but okay, the question I have for you is...
Thank you.
What is the etymology of amnesia?
It is ancient Greek, and it is I, meaning without, and amnesia, meaning memory.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct enough. Let's get this episode over with. Well, that is all from us, but before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit, and thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotGory everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Bye.
Adios.
Bye.
Adios.
Bye.
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 You want to say adios?
Oh, Luke, don't forget to say bye.
Bye.
Bye.